Okay, here we are with some questions today. This is an interesting one. I can't understand this. Oh, it's upside down. It was. The last couple of days, I have seen a bright purplish light, which seems to appear behind my left or right eye. The timing of its appearance is during the beautiful breath, which makes me suspect it is an emitter, but it doesn't last for more than 5 to 10 seconds. As soon as I focus on it, it's gone. I read in your handbook that this may be an emitter, and one cannot sustain it due to mindfulness being too weak. I have tried for 2 days, and it's no better. Any helpful tips to progress, please? Yes, don't try. Just make peace. Don't accept. Don't anticipate anything. Don't expect anything. Don't try and attain things. You answer the question here. As soon as you focus on it, it's gone. Don't focus on it. Don't do anything. Let it come to you. The simile which is the best for nimittas is Ajahn Chah's still forest pool. When he would go on just wandering in the jungle, you would always try and find a lake or a river in the mid-afternoon because you needed to bathe, wash robes, and also filter some water for drinking. And after he told me this story many times, that after, you know, bathing, filling up his water jar for drinking, he would set up his mosquito net about 10, 15, 20 meters away from the edge of the pool, and he would meditate there at night time. But sometimes at dusk, he would keep his eyes open because then the jungle animals would come out also to drink and bathe. But he had to keep very still because the jungle animals were more afraid of human beings than human beings were afraid of them. So if they realized there was a man there, even though it was a monk, and Ajahn Chah, they didn't know, there was a man there. If they perceived a man, they would not come out, even though they were really thirsty. So the only way he could watch the animals was to be perfectly still. And if he was really still, they wouldn't realize someone was watching. Then they'd come out and play. And he said it was great fun, like watching National Geographic, Nature Channel, watching the animals in the wild play around. And he'd have to be perfectly still. If he moved, made any sound, they'd know he was there and run away again. And his evening entertainment would be lost. And that's the simile he taught me for nimittas. If a nimitta comes up, you've got to be like Ajahn Chah by the still forest pool. It's like the nimitta is one of these animals coming out of the jungle. And if they realize that someone's watching, if you make a noise or move, try and focus on it, they will run away again. They won't come out. So you've got to be able to watch the nimittas as if they were animals, not knowing they're being watched. If you focus on them, they'll run away. If you get excited or afraid, they'll know you're watching and they'll run away. You've got to be that still, as if they don't realize anyone's watching. It's a brilliant simile, because that is a great simile which actually works. It gives you something to imagine. You're an Ajahn Chah by still forest pool, and all these amazing things are coming out. And then he said that if you are really still, then some strange, weird animals come out to play by the still forest pool. Animals who you've never been told about before. And they are so shy, they only come out when you're perfectly still. And of course, those are the jhanas. But if you move, if a jhana is coming, yes, they will hear you and they'll run away and they won't come back out again for days. That's a beautiful simile of the still forest pool. So don't focus on the nimittas. Don't do anything. Imagine you're an Ajahn Chah by a still forest pool. Just be absolutely still. And then they'll come out and play. Dear Ajahn, can spirits, demons or curses possess someone keeping the 5 precepts? Please explain. Spirits, demons and curses. My experience with curses was when I was staying with my mother. And this is my story. My mother wasn't cursing me. But She was staying in this apartment and she was making my lunch. And lunches are very important for monks, because if they miss their lunch, that's it for the rest of the day. You experience that now. So when somebody rang the doorbell and my mother was in the middle of making my lunch, I said, "Mother, I will answer it for you." Being selfish, of course. So I answered the door, and this was in London, and there was a lady called a gypsy, and she was selling trinkets door to door, trying to raise funds. And I was very polite and said, "No, thank you, we don't need anything." And that's when the gypsy said, "If you don't buy one of my things, I will put a gypsy curse on you." She didn't know who she was playing with. So I had my robes on and I stood up and I said, "I am a Buddhist monk. My curses are much stronger than yours." And that's what I said. And this poor woman, she turned around and ran away. She actually ran. It's really funny. I felt very good about it afterwards. I thought maybe I went a bit too far. Scared the life out of her. But it's true. We are much stronger, but we wouldn't curse anybody. But she didn't know that. You know, Buddhist monks, you know, in the West, you don't know whether they can curse you or not. So I had fun with that. But if you have five precepts, know the classic story, and one of the true stories, weird but true. This was in our monastery. This is Wat Nanachap in Thailand. There was one of the ladies, a young woman, she'd come every moon day to stay at the temple, keep eight precepts once a week, five precepts the rest of the time. So she was a very strong supporter, keeping her precepts, meditating. And she came to see us because one morning she was just washing her face in the mirror in her village. And instead of seeing her face in the mirror, she saw a monster's face in the mirror. And that freaked her out because, you know, she's not a crazy lady. The first time she ever saw something weird. You know, she was washing her face and then not her face, a monster's face in the mirror looking at her. And so what people do there, they come and ask the monks. So the monks went to her house, you know, to do a little blessing ceremony in the morning and have their lunch. And while they're doing the ceremony, there was an old lady in that house fainted. And when she came to, she was speaking in a strange voice. And the old monk, Ajahn Chah, the old monk who was there, you know, been around, knows what's going on. He said, "The spirit, this demon, had possessed this woman." Not the young lady. The young lady was just watching all of this. And just asked, "Who are you? What are you doing?" And he sort of said this was the spirit who had been hired by one of the spirit doctors in Ubon Ratchathani in Thailand to kill this girl. And the reason was there was a young man who wanted to go out with her and marry her, and she said no, she wasn't interested in him. And he was so upset, he paid some money to the spirit doctor, "Go and kill that girl." And this is an absolute true story. That demon said he'd been trying to kill that girl for 2 years and hadn't been able to get close to her because of her precepts. She has such a pure life, such good precepts, they can't get close. And the monk said, "Look, you're not going to be able to get close to her because she's a very good precept, a very good girl. She keeps very strong precepts all the time, a very good Buddhist." And then the demon said, "Well, if I don't kill her, I'll have to die myself. That's the deal." And the monk said, "Well, it's better that you die than you kill anybody else." And actually the demon sort of accepted that. So the monk gave this demon the five precepts. You know, she was possessed, this old woman. And then after giving the five precepts, the woman fainted. And she came to again, didn't know what had happened in her trance. And that was the end of the story. Now that's, you know, you don't have many stories like that, because, you know, you monks, you get into these really interesting parts of life. But the main message of that story, yeah, there are demons, but they're very rare. And if you keep precepts, they can't get close to you. You're totally protected. The other story, similar, just weird stories, especially on a night like tonight, because tonight is a full moon night. It's a great time for weird stories. The other story was a lady over here. I don't think I mind mentioning her name now, because many of you remember her, Ratana. She brought her mother over from Thailand because no one was looking after her mum. And, you know, she would look after her mother and just do everything for her. And she was one of the really good disciples of our monastery, Ratana. And one day that her mother got sick, so took her to the hospital, King Edward Hospital, over in Perth. And her daughter, Ratana, she was wondering, you know, is my mother going to survive or is she going to die? You know, what's the illness going to do? So she went to a medium in Perth, a spirit doctor, and she just, very cheap, only 20 bucks. And the spirit doctor could astral travel, would leave her body and go and check up on her mother to see whether she was going to survive or not. See if it was going to be the last illness or just another illness. All she needed was the $20 and the address, King Edward Hospital, the ward and the room. And then she'd go there and check her out. After about 5 or 10 minutes, this spirit doctor came out of trance. So the first thing she'd do was to give the $20 back. And Ratana said, well, what's going on? He said, look, I found the hospital, I found the room, but I couldn't get inside. He said, there was a force field around your mother, and I just couldn't penetrate it to find out whether she was going to survive or not. He said, who is your mother? I've never seen that before. And that's when Ratana said, oh, she's a Buddhist nun. She's been keeping the 8 precepts for about 30 years. At which the spirit doctor took the 20 bucks back. You should have told me beforehand. You're just wasting my time. People like me can't get close to people like that. And I remember Ratana telling me that story. That this is actually the power of your precepts. Now, as far as spirits or ghosts are concerned, you've got a force field around you. And that's what it feels like. They can't get close to you. They can't harm you. So if you keep your precepts, you're totally safe. But if you break your precepts, ooh. So there's many stories like that. So keep precepts and nothing can harm you. And it's very rare these things can harm anybody anyway. It's only very rare. And it's also a very stupid thing to do because it always bounces back on you if you start doing any of that sort of stuff. I mean, I'm talking about getting spirits to harm anybody. Dear Ajahn, are you on a diet? You don't seem to eat a lot. What are your favorite foods other than fish and chips? What about veggies and fruits? Chips are vegetables. They're potatoes. So I always have to have my three veggies every day. Chips. Now, I'm getting old now, so I usually like the food I had when I was a kid, because it tends to sort of digest okay. But look, I'm not on a diet, I just eat what I want. Actually, sometimes I don't want anything, so I don't eat so much. This morning you said, doing reinforces the ego. Excellent. How did the Buddha do and strive to make the Sangha and teach without reinforcing self? How should we do it at work? Is it by being mindful that our doing is anatta and won't lead to fulfilling happiness? Thanks, you rock. Actually, I am like a rock, at least the size of a rock, maybe. Anyway, it's more doing reinforces ego. It does reinforce a sense of self, but there are some doing like compassion and kindness. That really isn't a sort of doing, because it's not really nothing to do with you. It's helping and serving others. So, important in meditation, when you're meditating, you don't do anything, okay? You let go, you make peace, you're kind, you're gentle. But when you go out to work, please don't follow the same things you do in meditation. Otherwise, what happens is when you're crossing the road in the middle of town, lifting up my foot, pushing it forward, pushing it down. And it's the old story. You're going to get another terrible joke now. That was about the Vipassana guy. He'd been doing this slow walk in a Vipassana retreat. And after he finished the retreat, on a Monday morning, he went to work. He was working in Perth Zoo. And as he got in to work, He was so mindful. He walked so slowly and talked very slowly, mindful of every word. And so the head keeper said, just what can I do with this guy today? Because he was so incredibly slow after a week's meditation. And the head keeper of the Pursu was very smart. He saw straight away, you can look after the tortoise enclosure. Okay, I will look after the tortoises. And off he went, mindfully walking to the tortoise enclosure. And at lunchtime, the headkeeper decided to check up on the guy and make sure he was okay. And when he went to the tortoise enclosure, he found the gate was open and all the tortoises gone. And he said, what happened? And the meditator replied, well, I just opened the gate and whoosh. That is a stupid joke, but I love it. But that's why, when you're going very slow in meditation, even tortoises go whoosh compared to you. So when you're working, please start going fast. And when you're crossing the road, you're driving the car, please get back into gear. So yeah, you do and strive when you're out there working or building a Buddha, building up the Sangha, but when he wants to stop, he stops and does nothing. That is how the Buddha does it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for being here with us. I would never know what the sweetness of stillness is if I hadn't come on this retreat. Yes, the sweetness of stillness. What a beautiful word. The sweetness of stillness. And if I hadn't come on this retreat, I'd go through this experience. And the meditation is one part of learning to treat oneself with kindness and mindfulness instead of beating oneself up without realizing it. Makes me feel so good. Can I stay here for a month? Why not? Yeah, I know. Kick somebody out on the retreat next week. Yeah, there's a weekend retreat. You can always stay an extra 4 or 5 days until next Friday. This is the start of my journey for meditation, and my gift to you would be to continue practicing it in daily life. I love meditation. It feels so like bursting out loud. Yeah, it's actually good. I mean, this is excellent, because when you love meditation, then my job is done. You know, you like the meditation, having a lot of fun, a lot of peace, a lot of kindness, a lot of happiness. And then when you go home, you meditate. You come back here or other places to meditate because it is enjoyable. You love doing it. In one sutra, the Buddha said, this is a path without groaning. It's a lovely little saying. No groan. A path of smiling, of happiness, of religion, which makes you happier and happier and happier in this life, instead of having to wait until see if you've got the right religion at the end of your life. It must be really tough. You have to sort of, you know, Christianity, what type of Christianity, what type of Islam, they all say they're the only ones, and you don't know which one you bet on the right horse until the end of the race, and it's a bit late then if you bet on the wrong horse. But here you get happiness right now. Thank you, and lots of love to Bianca and Dania too. Bianca, for her loving kindness to all of us. You are like a mother to me, and the food, oh my God, salivates. And kind people who also bring us food too. Dania, for always being in such a happy state of mind, and it affects people around us. Thanks for taking care of us. Okay, back to meditation. Yeah, very nice. I like this. Dear Ajahn Brahm, now that you've been to Las Vegas, I have the courage to ask once more, would you please come to Brazil someday? As you said, you like challenges. We could organize a Dhamma talk in the middle of a favela, a slum, for the drug dealers in Rio. That would be interesting. As soon as they see me, this happened to me. I was in England once, And one of the monks over there, he started this putting Buddha statues in the prisons. And you know, these were the open prisons. He got permission to do this because anything to help these prisoners. So the very first one we went on, I happened to be there, so I went to the ceremony, installing the first Buddha statue in an open prison. And you know, to install the Buddha statue, we had a little ceremony of like walking around three times with candles and incense. It's an old Indian ceremony of walking around three times. And as I was walking around, I was getting so happy that, you know, a Buddha statue in a prison, you know, where people really, really need it. And just, even if you're not a Buddhist, seeing a peaceful, calm, happy being was a beautiful thing. And I was just so happy. There was a couple of prisoners, and they were, you know, they weren't into the ceremony. They were just waiting for it to finish to have the feast. And they were just standing around, you know, looking, and I saw them out the corner of my eye looking at me, and they pointed at me and said, "That guy's on the gear." Which in prison speak means, you know, he's on drugs. Got a big happy smile on me. And they thought the only way you get a smile like that is, you know, being on drugs. And of course I wasn't on drugs, I was just on meditation and inspiration. So if I went to see those drug dealers, they'll say, "Come on, okay, give me some of what you've got." So it might actually work. I get them all meditating. Anyway, speaking seriously, our Buddhist community takes themselves too seriously. Most of them study very complex texts. So your jokes and your ability to communicate in simple words, the vast world of the Dhamma would be immensely welcomed. Don't worry, we will take you to the beautiful parks of Brazil. Least but not least, you will come back with new jokes and stories to share at Jhana Grove. Isn't this fabulous? The one thing which Brazil offers is the coffee. Monks like, because I always have to take my vitamins every morning, and that's vitamin C. Vitamin C is very good for you. Vitamin coffee. Here's your first. Okay, you keep twisting my arm and see what happens. "You are truly a great teacher in teaching us to get lost." Every time I got lost, new things unfolded right in front of me, and I learned a great deal from them. So due to your boundless love to us. Cheers. So anyway, someone's got lost. But if you do get lost, don't call the RAC. Just enjoy being lost. "Dear Ajahn, there have been so many moods passed through me today, from gratitude to sadness, from joy to fed-upness. I haven't reached jhana level yet, but is there any benefit on reflecting on the impermanent nature of these states of mind pre-jhana?" Yeah, because they've got no control over these things. How many times do you want to control this? Just have gratitude, no sadness. I just want joy. I never want to be fed up. Can you control them? No, they just come. That's why one lady over there, she complained, she felt grumpy. And so I gave her a grumpy license. Not a happiness license, that's easy to be happy. But to give you permission to be grumpy. What a wonderful thing that is. You don't have to think you're failing if you're grumpy. Exert your right to be grumpy whenever you want. So that's why I gave her a license. So she's free to be grumpy at any time, for any reason or no reason. Do you feel guilty if you're grumpy? If you're angry and upset? That's the problem. So you know grumpiness exists in life. So be grumpy. Enjoy your grumpiness. Whatever it is. In other words, you're not out of control. There are times when you're going to be tired. There's going to be times when you're grumpy. There's going to be times when you feel so good. Which is the real you? None of them. So just let the just nature do its thing. And then you find when you really are grumpy, you're happy to be grumpy. And that means you're not really grumpy. So all these things, they come and go. So reflecting on their impermanence, they're out of control, nothing to do with you, then you are free. If there is no oneself, then who can do the bad karma or the good karma, and for whom? Okay. If there is no self, then I do the good karma and something else does the bad karma. That makes a good deal to me. Why not? Now, if you want to be philosophical about this, as long as you think there's a self, I'm not talking about theoretically, I mean sort of deep psychologically, that you believe you exist, then you make karma. If you can actually penetrate and see this as a truth, a reality, not just playing or making it up, but you know there's no self, then you're free of karma. You know that's why, as in Buddhism it says, the stream winner is no longer subject to the lower realms. If you're a stream winner, you can't go to rebirth in hell realms or animal realms or ghosts anymore. Why? The reason is because when there's no self in there, you don't, that bad karma doesn't exist anymore. It's called ahosi karma. If you realize there's nobody in here, then you can let go of all the bad karma. Just like that. When you think you exist, and you really take that on board, that yes, you are, then with that comes all the baggage of the past. If you can just realize there's nobody in here, then letting go of the past is just as easy as that. That's why a stream winner can let go of the past. So, let it go for goodness sake. Stop sending yourself to the ghost realms, the animal realms. As one of the people, they're not here today. When I asked them, what do you want to get reborn in your next life as? They said, as a dog. They said they want to get reborn as a dog. And I said, what do you want to get reborn as a dog for? And they said, because you don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. You can sleep all day if you like, and you get really good food, and all you need to do is to wag your tail and get stroked. That's your job in life. I said, that's a really good job. That's what I want to do. Sleep all day, eat good food, and just, you know, just play with people all day. No responsibility. So next life, he said, I want to be a dog. And then I told this guy, I said, look, if you're a dog, in the first weeks of your life, you get taken to the vet to get de-sexed. When I told him that, he said, I don't want to be a dog. He didn't think that one through. So be careful, that's been de-sexed. Yeah. Today, I admit I was restless, no doubt striving for some peace on the final days. From the morning, my mind was stirred, thinking, and after lunch, followed more striving, wanting. I was sitting in my room in the afternoon, feeling hot and bothered, trying to meditate, fed up, and I stood up and went and sat on the bathroom floor. Oh, the cool floor. And little did I expect, without striving, I slipped into a beautiful, peaceful meditation. Thank you for proving such lovely, cool, providing such lovely, cool en-suites. And of course, the wise teachings, much better, the cool mind, yes. So that's your real meditation room, the toilet, where you can let go of everything.
Constipation.
Yes, it's constipation, let it all go. So that's marvellous, so well done. And of course, you see there, you are striving at the very end. Please don't waste the last few days with striving. Thinking, oh, there's only a couple of hours to go, I've got to work hard, I've got nowhere, I've been messing around. No, carry on messing around until the very end. In other words, stop trying to do the final push towards enlightenment. Otherwise you just get so hot and bothered and get so frustrated. Carry on what you've been doing so far. Just make peace and enjoy every moment. Just be here. Soon, another sort of 24 hours, you'll be back in the grind, having to do things, all this responsibility, get things done. So please, enjoy every moment of this retreat. Dear Ajahn Brahm, why Buddhists cremate once they die? Why don't Buddhists do burial? Can you please explain? There was a hypochondriac, and he would be always going to see his doctor, every other day, with some new complaint. You know, first of all, Ebola virus, then bird flu, and then whatever else was going in the newspapers, he was sure he had it. And the doctor, you know, and there's a few doctors here, you probably know such people. They're just hypochondriacs, always think there's something wrong with them. And he was causing such a big problem to the doctor that one day the doctor said, right, I'm going to have to do some tough love on this guy. So when he came in, thinking he had PMS. You haven't got PMS, you're a guy. There's nothing wrong with you. You are just a hypochondriac. You make things up. There's nothing wrong. You're imperfect. He shouted at this guy. And the guy was shocked. And he was stunned. He staggered out the surgery. And he was so shocked when he walked out the surgery. He walked across the road in front of a truck and got killed. And the doctor heard the sound of the accident and rushed out. He couldn't save this guy. He was dead. And the doctor felt so guilty. He had shouted at this poor hypochondriac and killed him. And as a result of the shock, the doctor had a heart attack and died as well. So because they died within minutes of each other, they had funerals together, or just, you know, one after the other. And they were buried in the cemetery in adjacent plots. And just one day after the burial was finished, the doctor heard someone knocking on his coffin. It was a hypochondriac again. Doctor, doctor, have you got anything for worms? I thought that was a funny joke. So that's why we get cremated. We don't like worms. You want worms eating you up? It really sucks having worms eating you up. So get burned. It's much more fun. So no, you can, whatever's going. So we can get buried, we can get recycled, we can get cremated. So Buddhists, don't worry about what you do with your body. Dear Ajahn, what is the Pali Boka ceremony? The monks perform on... Oh, the Pati Moka ceremony on full moon days. I was just got a phone call from someone. I was just talking while the phone call was there about we just did the Pati Moka. And this guy, oh, you had a party today. A party mocha. It's not a party. We do the chanting of the rules, which we're supposed to keep. So we always do that once a fortnight. So we do the chanting of the rules. Dear Ajahn, is jhana still suffering? If not, can you try to stay there forever, e.g. 1,000 years? There should be no aging while the body is shut down. And is there life after parinibbana? If yes, what it's like? Is jhana still suffering? If you get into a jhana, you don't think it's suffering at all. But then you get into the second jhana, and you realize, oh my goodness, first jhana is suffering compared to second jhana. Second jhana is so much happier, you've got something more. Then you get into third jhana, and you realize, wow, second jhana sucks. So it's all relative, just to the peace and the happiness. And you keep on going, and you realize that parinibbana, when everything stops, is the highest suffering, and there's nothing after that. That's called Nibbana with nothing remaining. That's actually the direct translation from the Pali. Nothing remaining. So, but if you get into a jhana after you die, in other words, you know, you die and you go towards this nimitta, this light, when you die and you stay there, then you're in a mind-made body, not physical body, then you can stay there for eons. Not just 1,000 years, that's nothing. That's just a snap of the fingers. For the jhana realms, it's usually, how many eons is it? 5 or 6 eons, and an eon is about 36,000 million years, roughly. So, big bangs come, big bangs go, and you are just in the jhana, in the mind-made body. Universe is coming and going, and you are just so still and peaceful, having a great time. Sometimes you may think I'm making that up, but that is actually true. Yes.
For the benefit of the recording, you mentioned it's the highest suffering, you mentioned the highest happiness.
The highest happiness, okay. Highest suffering. Highest suffering. Oh, okay. Well, the higher you go, the more happiness is. But when you, it is high, but it's still suffering. Sort of, anyway, okay. Being relatively new to Buddhism, I am curious as to how common it is for people to enter into jhana. For example, what proportion of the monastics would have experienced jhana? How after and how often in a lifetime? This is one of the secret teachings. Because one of the rules in the Patimokkha, it's rule number 8 in the Paticitya section, we're not supposed to tell about who's got jhanas and who hasn't. And who can read your mind and who can't. Because if we told who can do these things, then some people you'd be very terrified of. Monks who can read. And if, for example, if I read your mind and I proved I could read your mind, what would happen next? What would happen next is that I'd be taken to Guantanamo Bay by the CIA. So I don't need interrogation anymore. I can get all the information from them, all the secrets and everything. Just read their mind. And then you won't need any interrogation. You know, you put the CIA out of a job. Any terrorist. They'd actually have me in Perth Airport instead of the security, and I just look at people and said, yeah, they're a terrorist, yeah. They've got food in their bags. Yeah. They were. It'd be much better than these other sort of things to sort of find out. You won't need to sniff a dog, you just have monks who can, and nuns who can read. Actually, maybe we can actually get a job that way, raise some funds for the nuns' monastery. So, 100% accuracy, yeah. Okay, can you please explain what are the 10 parameters? Can I finish this one? About jhana, yeah, monastic. How many monastics have experienced jhana? How often in a lifetime? Serious answer to that is until very recently, people weren't teaching jhanas to monks or to nuns or to anybody. And I heard, I haven't had this corroborated, but in Vietnam about 20 years ago or something, the monks all met together, they're the senior monks in that country, and they made a resolution not to teach jhana to lay people. They said it was just too difficult. And, you know, monks like me say, oh no, come on, we're going to teach it to everybody. Why not? In the time of the Buddha, lay people had jhanas. And to me, maybe because I'm born in the West, it's really unfair, disrespectful to people not to teach it. So, and of course we had the Vipassana tradition for a long time saying you don't need jhanas, it's just too difficult and too problematical, so don't even try. So because people weren't teaching jhanas, not many people were achieving it. They thought it wasn't necessary. Now there's monks like myself, people like Pal Ok Sayadaw, you know, like the nuns like Ayakem are teaching jhanas. Now it is popular again. So now it is popular, now we're teaching it, people are achieving it. So obviously if you don't teach it, no one will aspire towards it. They think it's something which was impossible. But no, it is possible. So when we teach it, then people achieve it. So again, I got into trouble for doing things like that. You know, teaching jhanas. And some of them I said, what are you teaching jhanas for? You don't need them and they're too difficult. And I said, yeah, they are necessary. And I stood up for them. Can you explain what are the 10 parameters? The parameters, these are spiritual qualities, and they were from the time of the Buddha. Because it was much later, the Mahayana invented the parameters. They had 6 parameters. And then when the Theravada heard about it, they wanted some too, but they had to have 4 more. So Theravada decided to have 10 parameters. You know, just to don't go one better than the opposition. And that's all it really was. So it's a very interesting, the history of the parameters, 6, you know, in Mahayana, basically what the Bodhisattvas are supposed to do. And so when Theravada heard about that, they decided to have 10 parameters, just to do 1 better, actually 4 better. I know, what are they? That's, I don't really pay much attention to them, but I know 3 of them are Sila, Samadhi, Panya. Virtue, meditation, and wisdom. Basically, Eightfold Path. So we all share that. And there's things like energy, wisdom, determination, dana, yes, all those other things. These are just spiritual qualities. You do these things and it gives you more power. I was told by a teacher if we stretch our arms or swing them around after our meditation, we might hurt the unseen beings around us. You probably hurt the seen beings as well. It is your understanding too. No, the unseen beings are very quick. They can move away before you even hit them. But certainly, you hurt other people. No, that's myth. Dear Ajahn, in all humbleness, you define jhana as a state free of all sense consciousness and volitional activity. How do you reconcile with the suttas which define the attainment of jhanas upon abandonment of the hindrances? The greater sense of series of questions answered Mahavedula and also increases of intent. He makes the rapture and pleasure born of samadhi drench, deep, and pervade. This is not you make. If you understand the Pali, number one, sometimes the translations are not that accurate because, please excuse me, but they were mostly translated by people who hadn't achieved the jhanas. And in a state free of all sense consciousness, even the suttas state that the first jhana, they have a thorn. It is sound, takes you out of that first jhana. They call it a thorn to the first jhana. Sound. It's the last sense which disappears. Just like it's the sound which takes you out of sleep. You know, it's the alarm clock which gets you out. It's sort of the sound of the burglar wakes you up, not the smell or the sight. So sound is the last of the safety mechanisms of the senses to alert you to danger, which is one of the reasons it's the last sense to disappear. And as soon as say, it is the sound which is the last to go and can take you out of first jhana. Just like in the second jhana, it is the vitaka vichara, which is the movement of the mind, is the thorn. And we all know that if you have vitaka vichara, you're not in the second jhana, you're in the first jhana. So if you have sound, you're not in the first jhana, you're out of it, on the edge. So it's pretty sort of clear that this is, the suttas say, that sense consciousness is gone. Even the very definition, these are to the Pali scholars or the ones who know the suttas, they make a very clear definition of first jhana, vivichaiva kamehi, vivicha akusalehi dhammehi. And I say that just to impress you that I know what I'm talking about. I'm not just a meditator, I am a scholar as well. Vivichaiva kamehi means separated, finished with the five senses. Five senses. Now, the word kalong ama is the five senses, like karma loka is the world of the five senses. This place, for example. So this is where five senses have gone. Standard definition of first jhana. So it's all gone. And the intent as well is all gone. You make rapture and pleasure born of samadhi, drench, deep, and pervade. This is where you don't make it, it just happens. As you develop automatically, no self, no intent, it just happens. The rapture and pleasure born of samadhi, remember samadhi is stillness. This is a pleasure born of stillness. This is talking about second jhana. That's that particular type of happiness, bliss, born of stillness. It just, as you stay there, it just, every moment is pervaded by that pleasure. In reference to the second jhana, I know it's only the verbal formation still. It doesn't preclude other subtle volition. No, this is the subtle volition. Interestingly, that having many disciples now who are Chinese, they check the Pali Suttas with the Chinese Agamas. These are the very early teachings of the Buddha which have been preserved in the Chinese tradition. And in the Chinese tradition, it's a very, very early rendition of the these suttas. They use a different word for vitaka vichara, for jhanas, as with other, and with other contexts. It's not the same as verbal formations. Verbal formations, they use that in other contexts, but in the context of jhanas, it's not. It is like the movement of the mind. Subverbal. And anybody who has an idea about these jhanas, they're called Uttari Manusa Dhamma, really incredibly peaceful, wonderful states. They are so powerful that as a monk, we're not allowed to tell people we've got jhanas. Nor are we allowed to say that we're enlightened. They're put up the same level there. And that's why that they're not ordinary things, they're incredibly powerful things. So that's why to the idea that you can actually think within a jhana, it just makes absolutely no sense and it is not true. Suttas can say that. But whether it's a sutta, you can interpret this way, you can interpret that way. But I sort of see those suttas as saying, no possibility of any thought. Because you know when you're thinking, that's even just, you know, it's not still at all. It's not even ekagata, not one-pointedness. Your thinking is two or three things going on at least. When you have sense consciousness, you have at least five or six things going on. It's not ekagata, not stillness, not one-pointedness. Anyway, now we come to down-to-earth questions. I have a question regarding my husband, who has passed away more than 20 years ago. Okay, I still have the pain in my heart that he sexually abused my children. Okay, it was like a dagger to my heart when I found out after he died. I had to watch my children suffer a lot, but I'm happy they are all doing well with their lives now. With the help of various Buddhist teachings over this time, in particular your teachings, the regular meditation practice, this has helped me a great deal. I understand the past is over, but I still feel the pain and want to know once and for all how to let go of this and be happy in my life. Also, why do people do such things to others? I trusted and loved him so much. Please shed some light. Thank you much, Metta. That was one of the things which was very difficult for me to understand. How a parent can sexually abuse their children. Now, to me, it's just, I literally cannot get my head around it, as many of you, but people do that. And so a lot of times that people say it's because they were abused themselves as kids. And because they've abused themselves and they haven't let it go, they lose their sense of self-worth. They don't really think they deserve to be a good person. And when you haven't got that sense of self-worth, you know, you don't deserve to be moral. You don't even try being good. You don't restrain those lower impulses because you think you're worthless. Because I know that people have told me who have been sexually abused, that's the thing, they think they're worthless, there's nothing there, that they're constantly dirty. And part of the way out of that is to give people back their sense of self-worth. It's the similes such as the two bad bricks in a wall. Yes, it's two bad bricks, but it's still a beautiful wall. There's 998 other bricks as well. And restore a person's feeling of self-worth is usually the way that they don't need to do that on other people. When you feel you have worth, then you can actually keep precepts, then you can be virtuous. If you haven't got any self-worth, there's no point to keeping precepts. That's why many prisoners keep reoffending. They're prisoners, they're criminals, they're the lowest of the low, they're scum. You treat them like that, and they become scum. There's no much point to keep virtue. But if you treat them with respect and just focus on the good part of them, then you restore their sense of worth, and then they can be virtuous. It opens up that possibility. So a person who has been abused, if they don't learn how to get their self-worth back, they will visit that abuse on others. And they'll be just unethical. That's one of, you know, it's simplistic, but it's much more complex than that. But that's one aspect of it. So if that has happened, I'm very glad to hear your children are having good lives now. Next thing is, please don't ever try to get rid of this and to think it never happened. Because that's the second part where you can never do that. You can never sort of say, it never happened to me. You have to embrace it. That's part of who you are. It is literally opening the door of your heart to everything which happened. Not just the nice stuff, the really unpleasant stuff. Because what happens when you embrace this, yes, it happened, and I allow it to be. It's not my fault, I don't feel guilty, I'm not negative towards it, it's part of me. Then it's transformed. It's when you dig it into your heart that it can change into fertilizer. The shit becomes the juicy mango. But if you always keep it out, then it will fester and get worse every day. So whatever happened to you in your life, you don't feel guilty about it. Because guilt just hides it. You're afraid of being punished. Well, that's one of the reasons why people aren't honest. They're not honest with their partners because they're afraid, if I tell my partner exactly what I've done, I'll get punished, scolded, my marriage will break up, and it will really hurt. That's one of the reasons why we lie. And one of the reasons why we lie to ourselves is because we're afraid of the consequences of guilt. So when we get rid of guilt and punishment, especially self-punishment, then we can be honest to ourselves, yes, this happened to me. And I don't feel bad about it. I don't need to feel guilty about it. I acknowledge it, forgive it, and learn the old AFL code. And then you take it in, accept it without any pain of guilt or anger. Those are the two things which stop the healing, guilt and anger. Let it come in with loving kindness, acknowledge it, and then it actually does get transformed. And you learn, this was a terrible thing which happened. I never want to do this to anybody else. I never sort of want to have this happen, but it's happened to me. I learn just why these things happen. I don't want it to happen again. You become a very amazing, wise, compassionate person. You need the shit of life to fertilize your wisdom and compassion. Keep it out and it just festers. So that's actually why these things happen. It's good your kids are getting somewhere, and they probably, if they can embrace what happened to them, dig it in and learn from it, they'll be much kinder, happier, wiser children than the ordinary people. You make use of the pain of your life to grow into happier, stronger people. More wise, more compassionate. That is actually how it works, and that's the only way it can work. So when you try and get rid of it, it's just like trying to get rid of your thinking during meditation. You can't do that. When you're kind to it, just like the demon who came into the emperor's palace, welcome demon, then it starts to disappear. Trying to get rid of it just makes the demon stronger. Anyway, dear Ajahn, I am pleased to let you know that I have been offered a place in the Faculty of Medicine in the University of Western Australia to participate in medical research. Isn't that wonderful? I.e., to bequeath my body upon death. So when you die, you're going to go, at last, to the University of Western Australia. It reminds me of this story. It's actually told me, I went to a lecture of one of the former governors of Australia. And he told the story of this wealthy family in the United States. They got this professional writer, this author, to write out the history of their family since they migrated to the United States. And they told the author, yeah, there was a few skeletons in the cupboard, like every family have these, you know, some of their family members don't behave well. So tell the truth, but don't tell it in the truth which in a way which embarrasses people. And when he came across one of the family members who was executed in the electric chair because he murdered his wife, he thought, how can I write an honest history without embarrassing anybody? And he came up with a solution. He said, this person, later on in his life, was offered a chair in a famous government institution where his death came as a shock. it was just like spin, how you could actually say things. So here, they did a bit of spin. You've been offered a place in the Faculty of Medicine in the University of Western Australia because you've offered your body when you die for science. So some places are available. Please contact Bequest Secretary of the Death, UWA. So if anyone wants to get rid of their body by giving it to medical research, very easy to do. It saves a lot of money. You don't have to do funerals. But that takes up so much time. And when you die, all these people have to come from all over the world and stuff. Anyway, you mentioned Venu Saiputra's relationship with his mum in the booklet. The word of the Buddha, acknowledging we have parents, is part of right view. Why? Despite my parents' attachment and care, I often felt the odd one out. It was partially through my family that I learned that I was of little consequence. Feelings of insignificance have ruled the way I view myself and my place in society, informed the greatly improved but still unhealed relationship with my family, with thanks and meta gratitude and respect. Now, this is a passage you find in some of the suttas where it says it's important, it's good karma to look after your parents. That's why when it says there are parents, what it actually means is it's an idiom, which means that, you know, parents are important to look after if you possibly can. But sometimes people say, what happens if your parents have abused you or if they have not really loved you? And in this particular case of this person here, that the parents weren't really good parents and you didn't think you were of much consequence. And because of that, you feel it insignificant. And that sort of initial part of life is very important, but it is very easy to overcome. You come to a place like this and you learn loving kindness. The door of my heart is open to me, whoever I am. So you learn how to love yourself. And if you still can't do that, there is a little exercise which I'm now going to teach you. For those who feel insignificant, that no one loves you in this world, you feel really down, depressed, upset. Can I have your two arms? Put them out, please. Your arms right out, right in front of you. Okay, good. And now bring them in. But follow me right the way around. And hug yourself. And don't forget to move around. Oh, that's very nice. Doesn't that feel good? If no one else will hug you, you can hug yourself. Anytime. And what that's actually doing is giving yourself self-worth. If you have found difficulty doing that, you've got a problem with self-worth. You can't even hug yourself and be kind to yourself. So please learn how to do silly things like that. You can do it any time. Just give yourself a nice hug. Yes. No one else loves me, but I love me. And it works. So sometimes it's because we don't do things like that that we feel that we're not worth anything. But you come here and do some meditation, you find, no, you're worth a heap. You're beautiful, wonderful. And that's what we learn here with meditation. All that negativity we had towards ourselves, we realize, no, it's a beautiful, valuable person you are. Have you ever spoken to a fully enlightened one? Thank you. Will they be born again? I reckon Ajahn Chah was fully enlightened because I lived with him for 9 years. And the one thing which really convinced me was after living with him for a long time, you know, so you check people out. They know, so they come up in front of you, give a talk. That's very easy to give a talk and inspire people. What do? When they go back to their rooms? So after many, many years, Ajahn Chah asked me to go up to his room to fetch him something. And I'd never been up to his room, his personal quarters. And I felt really excited. At last, I can find out this monk I've been following, whether he really is a good monk. When I opened the room, I almost cried. There's nothing there. I can visualize it now. It's just a mat, a very thin straw mat, a wooden pillow, and a spare robe. And that was it. And I thought, wow, that's a real monk. At that time, not only generals, but the king and the queen. You know, you go down and visit the king of Thailand, and the queen would come to visit him. And incredibly rich and powerful people, he became famous. So they were giving him all sorts of stuff. But in his room, there was nothing at all. That was a real monk. So that really convinced me that he had the opportunity of having all sorts of comforts, but he just had nothing at all. That was a sign of his mind, totally empty. And this is one to Bianca. She's not here. She's gone. Bianca, I thank you. We love you. So maybe give it to her tomorrow. Dear Ajahn Brahm, here we go. A joke. Dear Ajahn Brahm, there are two eggs in a frying pan. The first egg says, gee, it's hot in here. And the second egg says, ah, a talking egg. I like that one. So I'm going to keep that one. And you're going to hear it for the next three retreats in the world. Do you ever get angry at someone or something in recent years? The very nerve of you saying I get angry at somebody. No, I never get angry. Never. The only way is to check. Those people have lived with me a long time. Who's lived with me a long time? You ever see me angry, Burr? Dania? You don't see me in my room. Well, I bag things. Oh, I take it out. Blood in the cave, yes. Okay. Can we have some guidance prior to metta meditation tomorrow, please? Yeah, I'll do that guidance for you. Do the metta meditation. Dear Ajahn, I know there are a few Buddhist old people that live in retirement villages and nursing homes. They have no freedom to practice Buddhism. Very strict rules and regulations. Have you ever thought of building a retirement place for Buddhist people? Yes, I have thought of that, especially now I'm getting old. It's amazing, just when you get old, you think of retirement villages. So yeah, we thought of that. We're just talking with somebody recently about it. It takes a lot of money. First of all, the nuns' monastery, that's going to take most of the funds. Maybe afterwards a retirement home. So if any of you are multimillionaires, please, you know, just, you might as well just enter Parinibbana now and you can leave all your money to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia so we can have retirement homes. No, that didn't go down very well. Okay, never mind. No, it just takes a long time to do these things because as Buddhists in Australia, we're starting from scratch. You know, just like in Brazil and other places, you know, we've got no sort of assets. We have to build them up from nothing. So it takes us a while to sort of get up to speed with nursing homes and hospitals. And the one thing I refuse to have, though, is a Buddhist school. Because I don't think they should have religious schools. How old do you have to be, say, in Brazil, to vote? 18. Same as in Australia. Why? The reason is because if you're under 18, you know, you're not mature enough or experienced enough to choose a political party. So why should people under 18 be allowed to call themselves Buddhist or Christian or Muslim? They're not experienced enough to make that choice yet. So it's a very strong argument to say no kid under 18 should be allowed to call themselves a Buddhist, a Christian, a Muslim, or anything. It has to be their free choice. They're not able to make that choice yet. It's very reasonable and logical. And then it means that kids will be able to grow up with each other. So you won't have, you know, people going to a Muslim school and a Muslim high school and a Muslim university and all they know is fellow Muslims. That's one of the problems in our society. We sort of separate each other off too early, which means we don't understand each other. So that's religious schools just separate kids far too early. So it'd be wonderful. Just have state schools. So the Muslims and Christians and Buddhists, they play soccer together. They're on the same cricket team, which means that when they grow up, they can't have wars. How can you fight your friends? You know, he's a good bowler. I can't sort of kill him. He's important to my team. I don't get where he comes from. Anyway, dear Ajahn, I have no words to express my gratitude to you. Then how come you're writing this question? I have no words to express my gratitude to you. But I managed to find some. Thank you for putting my mind in the right place, you know, between your ears. I feel so fortunate to be here. Yeah, you've got to be somewhere. To learn from the supermarket with such a generous and beautiful mind who has such words of wisdom to offer. I thought they were just jokes. Thank you for the license to happiness too. I know this will take me a long way if I stick to your instructions. With lots of metta, thank you. Very good. Thank you so much. Please excuse me if I just make fun of things, but it's getting late. What is the most inspiring act you have done in your life? The most inspiring act is becoming a monk. That was inspiring. And can you tell us one event that another person did to you that truly gave you happiness? It's when that person ordained me as a monk. That gave me a lot of happiness. It's just like that person who went to a spirit doctor and they say, can you remove curses? He said, well, I can, but just how long the curse been there? He said, 30 years ago. And 30 years ago, it's a long time, and just what did the curse do? It's given me so much suffering. For 30 years, can you remove the curse? He said, what was the curse? It was the word, I do. You know the shortest fairy story. You know this. You know, like this fairy tale. It always has to start with once upon a time, and it always has to end with and they lived happily ever after. So once upon a time it starts and they lived happily ever after. And the shortest fairy tale. I got this from Malaysia. Once upon a time, a boy asked his girlfriend to marry him. She said no, and they both lived happily ever after. Why are you laughing? So no, the most inspiring act I've done in my life is become a monk. The most inspiring event that another person did to me was ordain me. I love being a monk, I really do. Dear Ajahn Brahm, days went fast. We have come to the end of the retreat. What do you mean the end of the retreat? It hasn't ended yet. I enjoyed all of your inspiration Dhamma talks. Jhana Grove's day was so beautiful. And if you are in another world, on top of everything, noble silence I've never ever done in my life. No one ever did it anyway. Did you do noble silence? How many of you talked? It's okay, don't worry about it. You taught me the joy arising from a still mind. Ajahn Brahm, I'm grateful so much, but I do not have a lot to donate in return. I can only spread metta in return and try to teach others Buddhism through my way of life as such. You've taught us throughout the whole retreat, be still, be kind, be patient. And that's the best donation. You be kind to other people. May you will get more and more energy and good health to keep up this work and change the whole world. Once again, metta, oh come on, that's a lot of responsibility. To change the whole world. It's hard enough to change you guys, there's only 60 of you. Thanks from the bottom of my heart for the invaluable things you've taught me. Yes, I agree. Next one. Dear Ajahn, do we have to let go to go to deep meditation? Oh, I've been telling you that all week. Oh, I'm going to kill myself tonight. Yes, if you want to go into deep meditation, the more you let go, the better. Dear Ajahn, what are the essences of life? What things we must do at least as human beings? Thanks long ever your Dharma talk. What is the essence of life? What is the essence of life? Tea? Cups of tea? That's really an essence of life, because without tea I'll die. Happiness, joy is the essence of life. Because find out what happiness is. It really is about contentment. What things we must do, at least as human beings, to try and do stillness. In other words, rest, relax. Because that's the biggest problem in people. They don't know how to relax and be still. Because if you relax and be still, you'll learn how to love. If you're always on the go, always doing things, you know, it means you're hating things. You're hating the moment rather than loving this moment. This is good enough. So your partner is good enough. You're good enough. This moment is good enough. If it's good enough, then you can rest and be still. So that's the essence of life. For the last question. My goodness, I have to translate this one. I unintentionally missed your talk this morning due to an accidental bliss in the lovely forest. Wow, you missed the talk. You know, this talk was so amazing this morning. Everyone was enlightened. So it's just such a shame that you missed out. Never mind. No. You unintentionally missed the talk this morning. It's all on tape. Due to an accidental bliss in the lovely forest. Excellent. When I emerged, it was beyond polite tardiness. I might as well practice letting go of my guilt. It wasn't easy. I kept the mantra of peace, kindness, until I felt like crying. Great. look, you don't have to come to my talks. Everybody has been to my talks. I say the same stories and jokes over and over and over and over and over again. So you can hear it again. What's more important than listening to a talk is actually experiencing the peace and the happiness. And you did that. Marvellous. So you don't need to come to the talk. Well done. It's a much better talk you heard in the forest. Then listening to the sound of nature, feeling the breeze and the warmth of the sun, I slipped in and out of bright spaciousness until it stabilises. It wasn't jhana, but I felt such peace and quietness. I walked back to my room with a silly grin, feeling such joy and lightness. Now I will practice willing my mind to emerge from jhana at a certain time. I do not want to miss lunch. With appreciation for your gentle, kind guidance. That's brilliant. Look, don't always have to come to talks. That's why I made sure we don't have all these schedules and bells. Because sometimes it happens. You have a beautiful meditation or you have a beautiful experience. But wouldn't it be terrible, you know, if we've sent somebody out to get you and to force you to sit down to listen to my talk? Now, I'm much happier that you had a great experience like that. You did much better in the forest than you would have done sitting here in front of me. So, well done. The most important thing is you experience peace and joy and happiness. That's the most important thing. So all the talks is trying to get people to do that. So if you're doing it already, you don't need to talk. So well done. Oh, no. Hold on, what's this one over here? Dear Venerable Ajahn Brahm, Bhante Jagtare. Okay. Here we go. It was a great opportunity to be on retreat guided by you. I was born a Buddhist in a Buddhist country where Buddha visited. The country practiced Buddhism filled with rituals and conventional truth. You're very lucky. I was born in a heathen country. I must have done some very, very bad karma to be born in England. That was okay. The country practices Buddhism filled with rituals and conventional truths. My mum meditated 7 to 8 months of the year for 20 years in a kuti, but traditional Dhamma was not heard at home at all. I studied in an English Christian missionary college where Dhamma was taught 1 hour per week, but it was not the simplified Dhamma, but meanings of Pali, Dhammapada verses, Eightfold Path, Four Noble Truths, etc. Though I enjoyed the classes, it was difficult because of the Pali language. However, I had some good karma to be a wallaby and had the opportunity to listen, that's wallaby is Australian, to listen to Simplified Dhamma by Venerable Bhama Wangso 4 years ago. That's me! My transformation started then and I got the insight to Dhamma when I listened to the CD of 2006 retreat. I have listened to this CD about 15 times. I used to listen to Jimi Hendrix over and over and over and over again. So it must be as cool as Hendrix. Since I listened to Ajahn's CDs to and from work while driving, also I've stored Ajahn's teachings in an MP3 and listened at work too. You listen to my teachings at work? Does your boss know what you're doing? Listening to Dhamma at work? They're supposed to be paying you, you know. I carry the CD in my bag wherever I go, locally or overseas, and give it to people who need it. I have overcome bullying at work against 6 people with loving kindness. Bang, I love you. Bang, I love you. Bang. No, you don't do that. Very good. With loving kindness meditation. People keep asking me who this Ajahn is. Can we meet him? And what I've learned is not to seek for anything in this life. If we follow Dhamma practice, practice it and be still, we'll see everything. All the doors will open the same way we open the door of my heart. Board Buddha plane that has no pilot, cockpit, and just stay. There will be a little turbulence at the beginning, but it will go away. Dear Ajahn, you have lit billions of candles off your candles. Lit. And yet, this candle will never burn out. It will always continue to light. Dear Dhamma friends, please light many candles as possible from the candle you got from Ajahn. Ajahn, may I ask you to give this to Bhante Jag to read the rest? Can you read?
Is it Pali?
No, I can't. Give it a go.
Could we all put our hands together in appreciation of Ajahn's great, profound teachings?
Yes.
to bestow many merits, to dwell in peace, and to liberate now, not yet.
Very good.
Sadhu.
Sadhu. Sadhu. Okay, very good. That's all the questions for this retreat. But I'm sure there'll be many more questions for the next retreat. So that's fine. So some of the questions I said were really serious ones, and I tried to make them serious. Some were serious and I made jokes with them. Please excuse me, because I was just thinking about everybody here to try and give them a bit of happiness and also to give them some instructions. But most of the instructions you've heard already. It's very, very simple instructions. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle with whatever you do in life. And then you find all the meditation comes together. It's very simple teachings. In the time of the Buddha would just give a short discourse to people that all go off and become enlightened. It wasn't complicated. You didn't have to have a university degree to be a Buddhist. You just went along and listened to some good teachings and off you went. And it all worked because the whole idea was kindness, peace, stillness. So please remember those things. And those things will create a lot of happiness and peace and stillness in your life. And you'll understand the Dharma not in the books, not in the questions, not in the talks. You'll understand them in here. It's just opening up the heart. Everything I've said here, you already know. That's why it makes sense to you. It's already stored in here, but sometimes we don't trust what we already know. We need some big shot, someone with a reputation to say, yes, this is what you should be doing. And that gives you the confidence to follow the teachings in your own heart. So may you go off and have a wonderful life and see you all in Nibbana. Very good.